gosh. Okay. Well, a fun loosey-goosey way to enter into our episode. Talking about what a professional podcaster I am. I'm the Sonny Crockett of Miami Nice, which is
one of us has one of us has to be.
You're the Tubbs. I'm the Crockett. I'm playing fast and loose. I'm taking a go fast boat with a hot girl. Yeah, that's me. You know fresher than whole. Riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking. Yeah. Can none of y'all mirror me back? Yeah, hear me rap. It's like hand G rapping his prime. I'm young H.O. Raps great for dead. Back to take over the globe. Now break bread. Welcome to Miami Nice. I'm Katie Walsh. I am here with my amazing co-host, Blake Howard. You know who we are.
Podcast impresarios, we are.
Podcast impresario, and we're here with another podcast impresario. Very excited about our guest. He is one half of the podcast Watching Movies at the Bar, which is a super fun podcast, has great guests, and I'm only saying that because I was a guest. No, the guest lineup is insane, and it's just a super fun podcast. So if you want to hear me talk about Tom Cruise and Top Gun, like very emphatically, you should listen to that episode. But there are so many good episodes. The Swingers episode is so good. The Batman and Robin episode is so good. Anyway, please welcome Thomas Grabinski.
Thank you so much. I think that's more of an introduction than I ever expected to have in my life. So I'm reeling, but I plan to get it together so we can talk about this incredible movie.
Yes. Well, I had to shout out Watching Movies at the Bar because it's a super fun podcast and I think people would really enjoy it. And one thing I love about the podcast is that I think just like the conceit of it leads to people talking about movies that aren't normally talked about on like the podcast rotation. So I super appreciate the way that it kind of feels fresh in that way because it's like totally different movies. And it's also the lens of like, would you talk about this at a bar? Or what would it be like to watch this movie at a bar? So
yeah, thank you. And the parameters of the show are really loose. I think it accommodates pretty much anything. But I found that a lot of my favorite podcasts would be shows that I would listen to after like a shitty day at work or when I was really tired and didn't feel like going out, but wanted the experience of sitting in a bar booth with friends, absorbing the conversation without participating. And so that's what we hope to cultivate.
For sure. It's just like ambient. And that's kind of what we do here too. We just sort of chit chat about this one specific movie.
We just use this as like a little campfire to gather around, to just get together, to talk to some fun people such as yourself, Thomas. But it's just, I feel like that's a good mood to be in because you're never actually, and this is what I miss right now in Sydney lockdown. It's so rare that you stay talking about the movie that you've even just seen at a movie theater with your friends. You then go back and you're like, all right, I've had some thoughts about Top Gun. And then it's like an hour of bullshit on Top Gun because you're like, yeah, that new movie came out and it was fine. But I really want to talk about Batman and Robin because the other day I watched it. And so I like that. I like that a lot. And yeah, it's a good hang.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like anything we have to say about Miami Vice will naturally dovetail back into Joel Schumacher and Batman and Robin. That's what this episode is going to be.
Look, the same bisexual lighting. Apparently everyone is just going back. Everyone keeps telling me about bisexual lighting and Basic Instinct. And I'm like, you heard of like the perverse misogynistic gaze of Paul Verhoeven? Yeah, I'm not sure about bisexual lighting being something that you're going to argue with me as what he was intending in some of these particular scenes, especially when Michael Douglas is basically assaulting Sharon Stone on the dance floor while the alleged bisexual lighting is happening right there.
Wait, can someone explain? I know bisexual lighting, it's sort of like the pink and blue lighting, yeah, but is that all the reference to bisexuality? Or is there something deeper going on?
Thomas, you might be able to help me, but I feel like it's like that is like the signifier of like, you know, this kind of like, I don't know, whether it's like this bisexual like inference in the lighting and those two things clashing together. But it seems that now people are like prescribing it to past movies like that was the intent of the directors, both implicit or explicit. And I'm like, no, some movies it doesn't work.
You know, I'm not always... Oh yeah, it's incredible. I would say that's a, I would say that movie is outright camp. But I, Blake, I'm not always compelled by the film discourse online. I don't always find it to be compelling. So I, for me, the jury is also out on bisexual lighting and its many applications. But I, yes, in Batman and Robin, 100%.
Yeah, 100% in that. But I saw someone arguing for it in Basic Instinct, and I was like, no.
Yeah,
Like, I think your theory
you're
is
going just, a little too far.
It does not stand. It does not stand up right now.
Oh, I meant to say in your intro, Thomas, that you are a film Twitter scamp. You bring scamp energy.
Tell me more about how I'm a scamp on film Twitter.
I think you have like a mischievous energy and sort of like clown on the heavy duty discourse in a way that I find entertaining and fun and funny.
Yeah,
in
the memes
of the day.
I guess I try not to meme too much, but I think a lot of times it feels like the movies themselves are secondary to the discourse, and the discourse is just so far removed from the things that I want to be talking about that I just feel like we're so stuck in the weeds. But probably a little mischievous. I think Twitter is the dumbest that I will ever be. I think it's a platform that really lends itself to idiocy. And so there is like a very narrow sliver of my brain that thrives in that space.
Indeed, indeed. It's like, if you're getting too serious on Twitter, like something has gone awry.
Yeah, and also when people try and have real conversations on Twitter is something that I'm constantly perplexed about. I'm just like, no. This is not the time. This is not the space. And also how people hijack conversations. I love Twitter scamp. Katie gave me the podcast impresario thing. Twitter scamp is just the best thing ever. And you must immediately change all of your bios to include Twitter scamp.
This means a lot to me. This is free branding. I didn't have to consult.
I try to give a little something, a little nugget every time.
It's fucking gold, Katie. It's solid gold. This like my friend, I mean, I'm sure Katie gets it too, and I see it all the time, but like a friend of ours, Jen Johans, is a great, like a beacon of light in film Twitter, a really great voice, has a great podcast, Watch With Jen. She's wonderful. And the other day she was talking about something on Twitter and someone hijacked her like, I wish more movies had color. Like, you know, was really vibrant with color, talking about a specific, you know, movie. And someone hijacked it to be like, yeah, isn't it great how Marvel movies by James Gunn have so much color? And she's like, please. And she's like, don't fucking hijack my Twitter thing about a film that is not a Marvel movie to go and like gush to a Marvel film director about how cool and colorful you think that
movie. Oh God,
was like,
yeah.
So gross. I was like,
no tagging.
That's exactly right. So yeah, exactly. Like you said, that sliver of idiocy is just really special on Twitter as well.
Yeah.
But it's
a sweet spot.
But I must admit, I have a much less dumb list of people that I follow. I really follow quite good people. And I feel like my world is like this little fun world that we've curated full of Michael Mann weirdos and Zodiac obsessives and inherent vice lunatics. I feel, and obviously heat nuts, in all shapes and sizes.
Heat nuts.
in all shapes and sizes. I feel like I've got like a nice corner of Twitter, especially of film Twitter. I don't get caught up too much in the absolute nonsense, I find.
Yeah. Michael Mann Twitter has really thrived in the past like several years. Oh,
yeah, it's going well. But the Black Hat Rebellion is just, it's, we need to squash it instantly. It needs to be squashed. Thomas is shocked. Here we go.
Can I actually make an admission at the outset here that's going to contradict a point I may make later? But I think you will love Miami Vice more if you've seen and appreciated everything else that Michael Mann has done. But I say that as someone who hasn't seen Black Hat.
Yes.
I'm really vexed by the discourse. Sometimes people talk about it in a way that sounds like they appreciate it ironically, and that kind of alienates me because I don't want to go into it knowing that, oh no, maybe this is just a late career miss for Michael Mann. But also then the people who love it want me to hunt down a director's cut that doesn't really exist.
Doesn't exist.
That aired on FX like one time.
Yeah, like, I just don't get it. That movie I'll send to you me the is file. Just this weird. I'll okay, cool. You. Thank you.
but I got sent the file because I was like, Blackout's fine, guys. You know, we all of our favorite directors make movies that are just okay at the very least. And I feel like I have a modicum more of entitlement to say this, but Chris Hemsworth is one of the most charming Australian actors that has ever walked the face of the earth. And the accent that he does in Black Hat is like, it's worse torture than Mads Mikkelsen whipping Daniel Craig in the dick with rope. It's worse than that.
His accents, this is one of my favorite.
I would be
topics.
Like, I'd be like, scratch to the left, like rather than listen to one more second of his accent in Black Hat. And then so what happened was Thomas is, I'm like, it's fine, guys, just relax. Okay. He can make a bad or just okay movie. It's fine. And then someone's like, Blake, I've got the director's cut for you if you want it. I'm like, all right, I'll check it out. And I watched it. Yeah. I was like, yeah, it's better, but it's not. I mean,
still just okay.
It couldn't hold the dirty laundry of even any of the other movies. I couldn't hold Collateral's dirty laundry. You know what I mean? And I think Collateral's like a good and to great movie. But again, there's a chunk of other Michael Mann stuff like the Miami Vices of the world and the Heats of the world and the Insiders of the world that are all above that in my personal rankings. But it's just fine. Directors are allowed to make okay movies, guys.
Where do you guys, so I've listened to a few episodes of Miami Nice, and I've heard you talk about your Black Hat skepticism, but not about Public Enemies.
I've had a really weird journey. I'll let Katie jump in a second. I've had a weird journey with Public Enemies. The first time I watched it, I wasn't such a fan. I've gone back to it a number of times. The great friend of the show and a friend of mine, Niles Schwartz, who's a film critic in Minnesota, wrote a terrific kind of, I think you could call it broadly a monograph called Off the Map, Freedom, Control, and the Future in Michael Mann's Public Enemies. It's like a little book, sort of like a long form critical reappraisal of it. And he just talks about it as this giant allegory for like the evolution of cinema. You know, digital versus traditional film, and just like talking about the textures and how it's this huge conflict, and the conflict sort of plays out in the movie allegorically, but like he just talks about that. And I've since then gone back and really enjoyed Public Enemies without like loving
wow.
it, but like really enjoy that conflict as it's playing out, because it is really that mashing of what you would consider to be, I want all these warm, beautiful, old time, you know, 1930s gangster tones, but the whole movie is just done with such, you know, scalpel digital precision that it feels like it grates on you the whole time. But I think that conflict is intentional. So I have a really good time with it now. It's not certainly not my favorite. It's probably in the second half, but I definitely, after reading Niles' book, I was like, and just as a bit of a tone poem of a thing, I'm like, yeah, I get it. But I also have heard some fun stories about how there's a rumored story that Michael Mann basically in the middle of Johnny Depp's performance at one point turned over and just said, you can't act. I figured it out. You can't act. And so I don't know if that is completely BS apocryphal tale, but I've come to kind of like go, every time I watch it, I just hear at some points in the performance that I don't think quite land to perfection. I hear that voice in my head go, oh, I get it, you can't act.
Oh my god.
So it's one of those beautiful things where I'm like, it's a funny concoction of a movie. But I do think it's you know, Stephen Lang is amazing, Marion Cotillard is amazing, I think Christian Bale is absolutely terrific, a lot of those little actors that are in it, even Channing Tatum getting run down in the beginning of the movie is awesome. You know, like everyone kind of has these awesome moments in it. I just don't know if the Depp performance completely works for me, but I love all those other guys in that movie.
I have to admit, I have not seen Public Enemies. I remember it was like so critically reviled when it came out that I was like, I don't need to see this. It's apparently terrible. Yeah. And I just haven't caught up with it yet. But I could not get on the Black Hat wavelength. I really tried, but I just couldn't like ride with that one. I mean, maybe I should watch the director's cut or try something else. But yeah, it didn't quite work for me. But I think that's why I appreciate Miami Vice in a way. I've I think you on rewatch, you start getting it more and more. And so maybe that will happen with those other films, but I don't know. It hasn't happened yet.
Thomas, where are you on Public Enemies?
Public Enemies, I haven't seen since it came out in theaters. And it also well predated my love for Michael Mann. I had only seen Collateral at that point, which is a movie that I really liked, but I had not yet done the deep dive. So I remember thinking very little of it, and I've wanted to revisit it since I've become something of a man head, but I'm a little wary.
Yeah, I think if you just manage your expectations that it's probably not top tier, man, but it's got some really great, like, when you look at a great director too, and this is just Michael Mann's kind of vision as a filmmaker and his compositions, there are so many amazing compositions now that people at the time were so railing against because there was that tension between digital and traditional sort of film photography that I think now when you look back on it, because we're so like our whole film language is now translated into this digital photography, it's like, oh man, he actually still shoots in such a dynamic cinematic way using digital photography. More people should actually take notes and go, how the hell did they do that? Like, how do they do those compositions? Because there's these amazing shots of like these stark, Katie, I think you would like this, is like stark concrete prison walls and like a guy standing there in a long coat shooting a Tommy gun and this like incredible blue sky, like luminescent blue sky above it, and like someone firing into like a gun tower with the guards and stuff like that. It's just like cool shots like that where you're like, they just hang around in your memory for a long time of like, oh, this Michael Mann knows how to shoot the living shit out of everything. So even if you're not quite engaging, that whole sphere of cinematic experience is just, he's still got it on a string.
Yeah. So Thomas, you said that you have become a manhead.
Yes.
And I feel like I maybe saw on Twitter or Letterboxd or something that like your brother, Ben David, who was also on our podcast, was like urging you to watch Miami Vice.
Yes, that is true. I guess in the same way that I'm a scamp on Twitter, I think there's also a very juvenile part of my personality, which is that I don't like to be told to do things, and I often have bad experiences when I'm told to do things. And obviously there is a time and a place for everything, but I think most times in my life I've been told to watch a movie or been sat down like, you have to watch this right now. That's just not the way I like to watch things. And so I learned my lesson watching Heat for the first time under duress, and I didn't have a good time because I wasn't in the mood to sit down for 3 hours and watch this thing. I didn't really have context for who Michael Mann was. And so anyway, when people told me to watch Miami Vice, I was like, I will get there. I want to do my homework. I want to watch everything, and then I'll get around to it. But Ben David's been a manhead forever. And so I was super reluctant. But by the time I got over the line, I'm fucking obsessed now. Like, Manhunter's one of my favorite movies. The movies I watched the most during the last year were Last of the Mohicans, Manhunter, and Miami Vice. I watched Manhunter maybe 5 times. I watched Mohicans maybe 3 times. But I'm not someone who watches a movie more than once a year. Like, I need a little bit of a recharge time, but this shit just compels me to return.
Tell us a little bit about your experience with Manhunter.
Yeah, I think I fell for Manhunter partly because my expectations were kind of adjusted against it. I think Manhunter is a movie that is kind of lost to the canon for most people because they think of Silence of the Lambs as being the definitive Thomas Harris adaptation, and so they just don't fuck with Manhunter. They think like, oh, you know, Manhunter was good, but Silence of the Lambs got it better. And I think I bought into whatever that kind of nebulous consensus was. And when I finally came around to it, I was like, I love Silence of the Lambs, but I might like Manhunter more. I like the way Michael Mann makes movies look. I like the way he makes movies feel. I love his needle drops. I think he has an incredible sense of music, but I also just, there's something about, I like movies that are macabre and movies that are spooky, and that is like one of the most electric macabre movies I've ever seen. And just the consummate professionalism of Michael Mann is very appealing to me. I don't think there's a movie like it.
Yeah, it's a special one. Katie, where's Manhunter? Because we haven't talked as much about Manhunter on my.
I know, I love it. I haven't seen it in a really long time. I really need to revisit it, but it's awesome. And I also was going to say, like, I think you were saying sometimes it gets underrated with Silence of the Lambs. I think for me, before I saw To Live and Die in L.A., I kept conflating those two movies in my head, the two like William Peterson movies, because they came out in 85 and 86. And I was just like, wait, like before I saw both of them, I was just like, oh, wait, the William Peterson movies. But yeah, I need to revisit it because it's been a while for me, but I love it. All of those like early ones are great. But I have a couple holes in my early Michael Mann filmography too that I need to fill in. So
yeah, I mean, you gotta catch up. We've got one cute minute following Miami Nice, so you better hurry up with that.
Oh, do you?
No, I'm just kidding. Oh. I'm just kidding.
Because I actually have not seen The Keep, and I was like putting it on my mental list the other day. I was like,
shout out to Meg Shields, who wants me to do one Keep minute, and maybe she should actually be the host of The Keep, because Meg Shields is the great writer at Film School Reject. She and also a Twitter scamp. Funnily enough.
Oh, hell yeah.
I should follow her.
she's great. I think she's the worst nun on Twitter. But she talks about, she thinks The Keep is like the video from The Ring, where like she's like, if you watch that movie on high definition, it's not the same. You need to like watch it on a shitty old video that you find that's unlabeled, and then at the end of it you'll die in 7 days. And I'm just like, I think that's a good professorial thing that maybe we should do. Just get more VHS tapes blank with The Keep on it, and just, like, just put it, stash
hide
it in
them
people's
in
houses.
Some woods.
Wait, so- I agree with that, sorry, because the only version of The Keep you can find legitimately is a very shitty scan. But have either of you seen the like bootleg 4K scan?
The 35 mil scan, yes. Yeah. Yes.
It looks incredible.
Yeah, I've seen it. It does look incredible.
So I had some anxiety coming into this today talking about Miami Vice, because the only way I've ever talked about Miami Vice is to be like, oh, hell yeah, dude, that movie fucking rocks, which captures kind of the range of my emotion on the movie.
That's kind of what we did.
Yeah, that's kind of what we did.
But I feel similarly about Last of the Mohicans. I think it works so well on a gut level. And I think, you know, on some level, that's insulting to how all of the gorgeous compositions of the movie and how well choreographed the action is in the huge scenes with extras, but like, it's maybe the best score of any movie ever. It's one of the most romantic movies I've ever seen. Also seeing Daniel Day-Lewis just fucking run and leap through the woods doing all of this action, like all of that, just the component parts of Last of the Mohicans are so incredible, but Michael Mann weaves them together so perfectly. And I saw Miami Vice for the first time 18 months ago. So it's pretty recent, and I've watched it a few times since. But I had been told to watch Miami Vice forever, but my friends who are big manheads always issued the caveat that were like, it's Mann's most Mann movie, but you don't want to watch it until you've seen the rest of his stuff. And I tend to agree with that. Again, I haven't seen Black Hat, but you get my meaning. Yeah, the first time I watched it, it was great. Basically what I did was I sat down and decided I needed to plug every gap in Mann's filmography, every movie I hadn't seen, and it was going to culminate in Miami Vice. It was a project. It was something I was really excited about. It did not let me down. I knew about the mojitos. I had a mojito ready for me, and I sat down, and the movie just knocked me down. And the first time I watched it, I couldn't totally make sense of it, because there's an element that's like a little bit campy and like a little bit elevated, but the fact that it's so soulful and dark, and the fact that all of the sort of dick swinging and machismo you would expect from a cop movie is undercut by sadness at every turn, it was just not the movie I thought I was walking into. And because there are all of these sort of competing ideas and this real darkness at odds with very funny one-liners, I understand why it's a divisive movie and why not everyone is a Miami Vice head, but I do think we can get everyone over the line. I do think everyone is capable of loving this movie in the way that we do.
That's interesting, because I also, the first time I saw it, I also was like, this is pretty campy, in the sense that I was like kind of laughing at some of the lines and moments and sort of thing. And I was like not quite taking it seriously. And the more we do this podcast, the more I'm like, this movie is a tragedy and it's so sad. And it's all about the doomed romance and you know, the Sonny's inability to like achieve, you know, true happiness and love with a partner, and like, kind of what, Brandon Streisand was saying, which was like, He's just this, like, what was he saying? Like something about how it's like he's the ultimate man protagonist.
And, yeah,
in the way that like the island, the tropical island functions for all of these man protagonists is like the heaven, and he kind of touches it, but he can't stay there forever. And so it's like he's the one that kind of, you know, gets as close as possible, but he can't be there. And so, yeah, it's interesting how you kind of have very different reactions, or at least I have had different reactions to the movie. I mean, like, we talk about this all the time, but just like the opening of the theatrical cut being like so ridiculous, and you're like, what am I getting myself into? But yeah. It's great. We love it. We love the blend of tones that this movie achieves. And also, yeah, I mean, I just like talk myself into seeing all these new colors and textures. And I think that's why we've been able to do so many episodes of this podcast.
Yeah.
I'm with you, Katie. I'm actually like kind of a buzzkill about this movie insofar as I love it, but I won't, if I can help it, I won't allow someone to have an iron.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience with this movie, mm-hmm, because I do think there is such a darkness and such an emotional depth to it, even if it's like, I don't know, like a sexy, hyper stylish movie. I'm with you. I think it's a tragedy, and I don't think this is a movie to be appreciated ironically. I think it's a movie to be appreciated in earnest.
The psychology behind it, and the way that the movies and the repeating themes and the continually revisiting these ideas, I think, is like why people get so into man. And like, and also what you were saying a little bit before, Thomas, like I also just love the way Michael Mann movies feel, and like there's just an effortlessness to them. And I think there's an effortlessness to Mohicans, where you just like swept away in this amazing story, romance, and like crazy action adventure. And it's just like, I don't know, you see enough movies where it feels effortful that you appreciate the effortlessness that man brings to just like the propulsive momentum that these movies have. And that's what I am like so addicted to when I'm like watching his film. So, and Miami Vice is like that too. It's like, you cannot get off this ride. You're just going and going and going, and like Sonny can't get off the ride.
Totally. The effortlessness you're talking about is really interesting, because I think with Miami Vice, it does feel kind of effortless. And I think if you're not invested in Michael Mann's filmography and you're not approaching the film charitably, some of it might feel a little bit haphazard. But right. To me, yes, it's such totally. A cohesive tapestry.
Right. There's we've talked about this a little bit, like there's like chaos around the edges. And so even if he's as prepared and as professional as a filmmaker as he is, there's still all the wild stuff that's going on behind the scenes.
There's chaos at the edges, and there's chaos in the middle of the frame, right, with Colin Farrell. Like, that's right, exactly. The beautiful mess of this movie is that,
right,
at the end
but
of the
that,
day,
that tension of like, yeah, the craft and then also the chaos like meeting is like why it's like kind of compelling, as compelling as it is.
I know obviously this is well-trod territory, but because you're mentioning the chaos of Colin Farrell's performance, I want to talk about it.
Yes.
I think it's like, you know, it's the most obvious element of the movie, but like, he's fucking incredible. And yes. in rewatching for this recording, I was like, I don't need to convince anyone else that this is true, but for me, this is one of the all-time great performances. And I don't want to romanticize the use of sort of hard drugs and substances as a means to iconic performance, but the fact that he was basically blacked out for run of show gives him this like dark, invincible quality that kind of reminds me of Tom Cruise. It's like there's no second guessing, there's no self-doubt. He just delivers all of these goofy lines with conviction like you've never seen. And in the same way that I think Scientology makes Tom Cruise fearless and makes him do crazy shit and makes him jump off the buildings, it's like for all intents and purposes he's a maniac, but I love watching him do things because he's not afraid. And Colin Farrell, because there is a part of him that is so distant, he's just utterly fearless, and it makes for a totally singular performance.
South Florida, they're a big buyer.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, we want to go beyond rule number two.
Why are we going exploring?
Who's the we? The only thing you've contributed so far to this is bad intel.
How's that?
Jose Yero, cocaine producer. Yero's middle management, part of a bigger transnational operation run by Archangel De Jesus Montoya.
Montoya's the new news. Globalized.
Moving.
Colombian coke NH, arms from the Ukraine, E from Holland, pirated software from China into Brazil.
What's this got to do with the price of tea in China?
We're seeing their ops. Transpo. You know, money laundering networks.
It would take years to put together a deal like this.
We want to stay under. Run in load number two and keep going. And hold off Boston, the ABs or Euro. We illuminate Montoya's operations from the inside. No one has ever tread before where we are now.
No, the answer is no. We take the Aryan brothers, the shooters, pressure them for the leak. It's a bird in the hand. I'm not changing my op plan for speculation masquerading as intel. Look, I know undercover requires aggression, some outlaw attitude. Now, how else do you lie down with dogs?
Go okay, fuck yourself. Like you know what this prick's game is? Mm-hmm. Get his picture in the Miami Herald of a quick bust. Save his punk ass career at the slug farm in D.C. We are not backing off this.
That's it. Where are you on this?
100% with Sonny.
Change the mission statement.
I have to run it past my ADO in D.C.
Hey, Slick. Don't try and shine me on. You don't have the time or the skill. If I close this down, I will close it down right now. Then you get sick in Washington.
All right, do it.
You fucking better be right.
So what's going on?
As in
there's undercover, and then there is which way is up.
Well, you think I'm in so deep I forgot?
I will never doubt you.
It's scary because, you know, Michael Mann talks about it. Like one acting performance that I really relish of his is the Will Smith performance in Ali. And he's like, we trained Will for 11 months, dialogue coaches, boxing training, fitness training. It was 11 months of like immersive preparation. And towards the end of the performance, Will Smith's only talking to his family as Ali, you know, all that crazy stuff that, you know, basically imposing method on people, but like for an immersive period of time. And I just think that they do all of that so that it is effortless on screen. And I still think that for some people who do go to all those lengths, they still have this awareness. Like, it's almost like when you watch a hilarious comedy, and I actually love this in comedies, where you see someone just about to break, like they're going to bust in a comedy, and you're like, oh my God, they're going to bust. This is so funny. Like, it just makes that each line that they keep their face straight, it's just that little bit funnier. But with Colin Farrell, he's gone.
Yes.
There's no other, that's not Colin Farrell. Like, that's what's insane. There's not Colin Farrell anymore. It's Sonny. And how he's able to actually be, this is like the true, like, attic transcendence. Like, there's a lucid human being there, like high functioning, lucid human being who can remember lines and shit, but it doesn't, all of the artifice is just gone. And so, being able to harness that, it's crazy. Like, I don't, like that transition from looking out the window to then aggressively attacking Nicholas in the apartment. I think about that transition a lot, of like this wistful, longing, tragic hero, and then straight to aggression. And I'm like, there is no, he's just got it on a string. Like, he's completely, how he goes from those moods and tones, it's so organic. It's crazy. Like, it just shocks me. Whereas like where Jamie Foxx can speak quickly like Ricardo and says that like really rhythmic line and claps his hands, you're like, oh, Jamie Foxx is killing it right now. Like, he's just
right.
You have a completely different view. You're like, oh, he's awesome. Oh, look at Dominic Lombardozzi. Go Herc. You know, I love seeing Herc in Miami, you know? But it's like, you see these people, but with Colin, he's off.
Oh, yeah. Love that Thomas, like you say, he's like, there's no self-doubt, and there's like he's just going. It's like super, it's just instinct and like primal. And it is a lot like Tom Cruise, which is like a great comparison. Is like, go, move. Like, and he's just acting on instinct in a way. And I think it just creates for this like absolutely magnetic performance where he's like, yeah, he's gone.
He's gone.
Colin is gone. He is out to lunch, but he's fantastic. It's like when you're really drunk and you're like, I'm a great dancer, and you know.
Katie, stop telling stories to the guests and to the people listening about me being drunk and dancing.
One time I was really drunk at a gay bar and I was voguing, like, this guy came up to me and was like, are you that girl from YouTube? I was like, no.
He didn't say hola chica.
But like, he like thought I was like a voguer from YouTube. And I was like, no, I'm just drunk enough to like not care what I look like.
I actually don't. There is no care. I have no inhibitions.
Right, but like, it's like that confidence. It's like you have to hit that sweet spot of just like, I am drunk enough that I'm like so confident, but I can also like, I also have a weird superpower of like voguing right now. Like, how did that happen?
You know what?
It's like his salsa dancing, even though he trained for 3 months.
Thomas has unlocked it for me. It's like that recent meme that's been going around where people run up the crates and they usually just wipe out in the worst possible way. But Colin Farrell's like the guy who's had 20 beers and then just dances up there like he's a ballet dancer. Like, he's that kind of like balletic, like just trots over and just nails it. And all of his friends are standing around going, he didn't die? Like, what? Like, how did that even happen? And he's like, no, this is me.
But all the while, he thinks that he's on a brick and mortar stairwell, right? Like, that's the thing. Yes. And I Katie, I love your characterization. And Blake, you said something about how, because he's absent, there's no room for that self-doubt. And a thing that I think a lot about in performances that really bug me, I agree with you, in comedy, it's fun when you can kind of see that gap between actor and character. But in a movie like this, if there was any sort of winking when he says, I'm a fiend for mojitos, or hey, darling, like, you would be lost immediately. You would not be interested in that performance. But there is no Colin Farrell there to be like, is this weird? He's just fucking doing it.
Yeah.
And God, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fact that he is dead serious about all those cheesy Crockett lines, like, makes it work. Like, no one, like, imagine Ryan Reynolds saying,
no,
you got your tan in Miami. Or like, any of them. I would crawl out of my skin.
Van Wilder Miami Vice is not the movie I want to see, because that's basically what it would be. It would be the worst. But even like Barry Shabaka Hanley does it too. Like, hey, don't you try and shine me on. And you're like, Barry Shabaka Hanley gets it too. He's like, we are just all going for it, and we cannot hesitate in any way, shape, or form. Otherwise, it's all over. It's all over.
I even love when Tubbs says, "Let's take it to the limit one more time.
It's just,
and it's like, oh my God, this is kind of corny, but like, I'm kind of loving it, and yeah, I'm all in, and I do want to take it to the limit one more time. I will do that, Jamie Foxx. I mean, Tubbs.
I want to ask you, sorry, from a consultant perspective, and I think you can tag in on this. It's like, you're working with scripts. There must be an art to your reading to go when you're looking at a script and you're sort of advising on it to talk to a filmmaker about the degree of difficulty of like, all of these lines can work, right? All of these lines can work. And on paper, I'm reading them and I feel where the traps might be.
Yeah.
But the degree of difficulty, if you're reading that script going, shit, every one of these lines could either be a car crash or it could be the most awesome thing anyone has ever put on a cinema screen. Like it's, there's only those two things I find with Miami Vice so much of the time. It's like car crash, like literally wipe out worst possible scenario. Like we said, with sort of the Van Wilder of it all, like winky, winky. Or awesome, like completely, tonally awesome. And I think that, man, what a hard knife's edge to navigate. Now thinking about it in just pure script terms on a piece of paper, like, God, how did this even work?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that if I read Miami Vice and didn't know it was going to be a Michael Mann film, like if I read Miami Vice and it didn't have a cover page, I don't know that I would be able to find a way into it. And yes. But that's why I think sometimes when production companies and financiers are reading material in a vacuum before talking to the filmmaker, I understand that it's ultimately a bandwidth issue and you can't meet everyone. You can't hear everyone pitch on every piece of material. But I do think there are things that just don't quite make sense on paper without context, without that kind of filmmaker's prism. And I've worked with a lot of people who are very scared off by movies that ended up being very cool, but were just very peculiar and needed some sort of framing. I don't know. I mean, it's not a hard science. It's all alchemical. And, you know, it helps if you've seen a movie made by the person who's going to make the thing you're reading.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, it's like tone and rhythm and, you know, just like the approach is, I'm thinking about this, total tangent, but like I've been thinking about Flatliners a lot because I'm doing the screening of it and at the American Cinematheque soon, and like, to me, it's like the script is kind of weird. I mean, it's a crazy concept, but then you get the production design and you get Joel Schumacher and you get, and like that to me is just such an example of like what a director brings to a script, because otherwise in anybody else's hands it could be like totally weird, but instead it's this like high camp kind of gothic spiritual take on life. And I don't know, I just like every choice that is made in that movie, it's like kind of makes it heightened and campy in a way that's not necessarily funny, but that is more interesting than what it would have been in anybody else's hands.
Am I wrong? Or is the first line of that movie, there's like a 20 second helicopter shot to Kiefer Sutherland who like puts his sunglasses on and says, "Today is a great day to die." Is that right? Yeah. It's like the best shit you've ever seen. And that you can't read that. You have
right,
to have someone explain
that.
To you how long that shot is and that the sun is setting and that he's holding the sunglasses just so.
But right, I was
like,
just,
there's a whole scene where, sorry to keep talking about Flatliners, but there's a whole scene where just on paper, it's just Kiefer Sutherland and Kevin Bacon talking to each other. But then Kevin Bacon just climbs out of a window and you're like, why is he doing that? There's no reason for him to be exiting a building by climbing out a window, but he's just doing it. It's like, anyway, sorry to talk so much about Flatliners.
I was gonna take us deeper in the Joel Schumacher of it all, is like, and go The Lost Boys.
Oh, God,
the tone of The Lost Boys,
yes,
is so unique because everyone is in it. Like they're in the theme. It's unironic. And you might watch it and like have a cackle at the saxophone guy, Like, that's about it, right? And you might, if you're really into the Coreys, you might, like, laugh at them, like, sort of just basically maintaining their comedic persona. But the rest of the movie houses this, like, insanely vivid and really, like unironic vampire story. And it's, although it's very gothic and stylish and sexy and, like, punk rock and all those things that it is, and like kind of like you know, flirtatious across the sexes and all those sorts of things and ambivalent, it's awesome. Like, it just like it, that tone is just so, that's such a singularly tonal movie where you're like, it, I don't know how it works, because if you look at someone else's, someone could make, you could read that on paper and someone could make it ridiculously dark or ridiculously stupid,
right?
And it just seems to completely find its tone.
I was just, I don't know how you don't think those vampires are like the coolest people on earth. I'm just like, even as any age I am, I'm like, Alex Winter, Kiefer Sutherland, the whole vampire crew. I'm like, I love these guys. They're so cool.
It's like that meme. Like, I'm going to tell my kids this is Led Zeppelin. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, you just like put the vampires from The Lost Boys. Sorry, Thomas.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, you know, I agree. I think The Lost Boys rules. But if you were to take that exact script in a parallel universe and produce it in 2020 and put it through the Netflix machine, and they just kind of make it look ugly and they give it to someone without a vision, and it's just kind of an open directing assignment, that would be an utterly forgettable movie. No one would see it. No one would remember it.
Right, and it wouldn't make them feel anything. And like, I saw a tweet the other day that was like, you just, like, in terms of screenwriting, like, think about the emotion and then you think about the plot. It's like, no one ever says like, oh, like, well, that movie didn't make me feel anything, but it didn't have any plot holes. Like, I mean, you can, if you're feeling the right things, then you're not paying attention to the plot holes. You could have a thousand plot holes in The Lost Boys and I would still just be like, oh, I love Alex Winter's jacket. Like,
I'm going to take this from like low and high art for a second and do the greatest, like, sorry, clanging name drop that has been on this show. Are we ready?
No, I can't wait.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I was talking to Peter Weir the other day.
No, what the fuck?
Podcaster and Commander. I'm going to put so many fucking clangs. People have just heard 1,000 clangs right now. And I quickly mentioned how insanely rewatchable that Master and Commander is in preparation, you know, talking to him a little bit of that movie. And he said, it surprises me that you say that because it doesn't have a lot of plot. He goes, it's a very atmospheric, we designed it with as to be a very atmospheric, immersive movie that didn't necessarily rely on plot. And we didn't get to go into like a more lengthy conversation, as I think we've done now, about like that, because I think our whole conversation has worked into that like mood, tone, atmosphere thing. But that's, I think that he just kind of unintentionally nailed something of like, so much of movies is about emotion and feeling and place.
Yeah.
And those things can, they have such, maybe there's kind of two kinds of people where you can like be that person who loves a procedural kind of NCIS, CSI, kind of like, you know, Criminal Minds, Law and Order. Like, I need to have plot, 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 plot. And that's my little comfort. Whereas I think the three of us, you know, and a lot of the people who love these movies and a lot of people who like Michael Mann movies, it is so much less about plot. The more that you immerse yourself in the text, it becomes about all the feelings and all the moods and all the tones of those things. And that intuitive alchemical level of viewing is so different to just plot, plot, plot. Cause I don't give a rat's about plot. Like, I'm not looking for an Easter egg about which Marvel superhero is going to be in the next thing. I don't care. I care about, you know, the crazy transition to Chakra's Blacklight Fantasy from Nam Encore at the beginning of Miami Vice. I care about that way more than I care about any of the plot. Like, I care about how the music changes and shifts and how I feel like I'm in that club and how much I want the cold delight of a mojito hitting my lips, you know? Like, I think that's a really interesting way of viewing. Like, some people have thought about plot being why you revisit something, because you like the intricacies. Whereas I'm not like that at all.
Yeah, I think the plot of Miami Vice, like, I think obviously Mann knows the plot, and but there are so many times I've watched it where I'm like, what's happening? Why? What? Like, I mean, or the first couple of times where it's just like, wait, who's doing what? Okay, the loads. But yeah, he kind of is just like he's making superior the vibe and the feeling and the atmosphere and the character rather than the stuff with the Aryan Brotherhood and all that stuff. I mean, that has to happen for everything else to feel the way it does, but it's not the most important part of the movie, at least for me.
Yeah, I think if you go into Miami Vice expecting something with sort of the perfect script level construction of Heat or The Insider, which I think are both masterful screenplays and incredibly satisfying on that level, irrespective of all of his great filmmaking qualities, Miami Vice doesn't have that, but doesn't really aspire to that. I feel like Miami Vice is about doing with the filmmaking, the lifting that the script does in those movies. Yeah. And I think it's really satisfying.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely a good point that like the filmmaking itself and the acting, the screenplay, the music, all that stuff is filling in the narrative pleasures that you might be looking for in something like a Heat or an Insider.
Well, look, Thomas, this has been such a treat to talk to you. You've definitely inspired a thought that I've just had, which is maybe I should get totally blackout drunk for every one of these podcasts and just see if there's a better podcaster inside me than there has been.
Not for me.
Katie's like, please don't, please don't, please don't, Blake, please don't.
I'm just saying I don't want to do that myself. You can do it. I want to see the 1,000-yard stare.
The 1,000-yard stare.
Colin Farrell was doing hard drugs as well, so you should figure out what the proper cocktail is.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, speaking of alchemical mixtures, yeah, let's. I'll have to talk to my wife, sweetie. I promise it's for a podcast. I'm just on hard drugs. I'm going out with Maradona for a podcast. Okay.
Another round two.
Oh God. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much for being a part of the show, man. It's great to talk to you. It's great to find another man head out there that can speak so insightfully on it. And I think so eloquently about all of those, you know, I don't know, sometimes they feel like unquantifiable stuff. But I think what's really fun for me is like hearing how people unpack it and rationalize it and approach it in completely different ways. And it's also like interesting to see how like your momentum as a man head has been late. Like I love that too, when people like find it and they're into it. It's so awesome. But it's been such a pleasure to chat to you, so thank you so much for doing the show with us.
Thanks so much, both of you. This was great.
Thanks, Thomas. It was great talking to you. And everybody listen to Watching Movies at the Bar. Super fun. Drink a mojito. Maybe you should do Miami Vice.
We will do Miami Vice. There's so many thoughts. We'll do this again.
You have to.
Yes. All right, thanks so much.
Thanks. Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often one minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.